Cambridge International Examinations. International General Certificate of Secondary Education. November Examination Series, 2018. English as a Second Language. Extended Tier. Listening Comprehension. Welcome to the exam. In a moment, your teacher is going to give out the question papers. When you get your paper, fill in your name, centre number and candidate number on the front page. Do not talk to anyone during the exam. If you would like the recording to be louder or quieter, tell your teacher now. The recording will not be stopped while you are doing the exam. Teacher, please give out the question papers, and when all the candidates are ready to start the test, please turn the recording back on. Now you are all ready, here is the exam. Questions 1 to 4. You will hear 4 short recordings. Answer each question on the line provided. Write no more than 3 words or a number for each detail. You will hear each recording twice. Question 1. A. What does the woman decide to buy in the market? B. What is she going to make?
Can I help you?
Yes. What have you got on special offer today?
Well, let's see. You can have 3 lemons for the price of 2. They're lovely and fresh, just delivered this morning. Or there are these strawberries, all half price, picked yesterday.
They look good. And how about the apples?
They're reduced too, and they're very sweet.
I'll take some of those then, please.
Right. They're great for making juice.
Yes, they probably are, but I want to put them in a cake. They'll be perfect for that.
Oh, okay. So, how many would you like? Can I help you?
Yes. What have you got on special offer today?
Well, let's see. You can have 3 lemons for the price of 2. They're lovely and fresh, just delivered this morning. Or there are these strawberries, all half price, picked yesterday.
They look good. And how about the apples?
They're reduced too, and they're very sweet.
I'll take some of those then, please.
Right. They're great for making juice.
Yes, they probably are, but I want to put them in a cake. They'll be perfect for that.
Oh, okay. So, how many would you like?
Question 2. A. Where does Jack suggest meeting his friend tomorrow? B. What time have they agreed to meet?
Hi, Ryan. It's Jack. I'm just ringing about tomorrow, as you kindly offered to give me a lift into college with you. Slight change of plan, I'm afraid. Would you mind picking me up outside the library? I know we said we'd meet outside the cafe, but I've just discovered that street's closed all the way down to the park. I think we arranged to see each other at 8:35, didn't we? So could you call me before 8:15 if there's a problem? I'll just cycle as usual if you can't make it. My first class isn't until 9:30. Thanks, Ryan. Hi, Ryan. It's Jack. I'm just ringing about tomorrow, as you kindly offered to give me a lift into college with you. Slight change of plan, I'm afraid. Would you mind picking me up outside the library? I know we said we'd meet outside the cafe, but I've just discovered that street's closed all the way down to the park. I think we arranged to see each other at 8:35, didn't we? So could you call me before 8:15 if there's a problem? I'll just cycle as usual if you can't make it. My first class isn't until 9:30. Thanks, Ryan.
Question 3. A. What was the subject of last night's TV programme? B. What aspect of the programme did the woman particularly like?
Hi, Maisie.
Did you watch that TV programme I told you about last night?
Oh, wait, let me think. The one about sport?
That was last week. This was all about animals. It was brilliant.
Yes, I did. I'd expected it to be a bit boring, to be honest, but it was great.
I'm glad you liked it. I thought the presenter was good. He told us lots of stuff I didn't know.
Yeah, I quite liked him too. Although it was the music that really impressed me.
The filmmakers had matched it so well to the videos they'd made.
That's right.
Hi, Maisie. Did you watch that TV programme I told you about last night?
Oh, wait, let me think. The one about sport?
That was last week. This was all about animals. It was brilliant.
Yes, I did. I'd expected it to be a bit boring, to be honest, but it was great.
I'm glad you liked it. I thought the presenter was good. He told us lots of stuff I didn't know.
Yeah, I quite liked him too. Although it was the music that really impressed me.
The filmmakers had matched it so well to the videos they'd made.
That's right.
Question 4. A. What did the man do on his holiday at the coast? B. What was the weather like while he was on holiday?
Did you go to the coast for your holiday?
Yes, same place every year. I love it. And you can go sailing and windsurfing now.
Right. So is that what you did?
I had hoped to, but as you know, I hurt my foot shortly before leaving, so those sports were out of the question for this year. So I went riding. I managed okay and it was fun.
And did you have good weather?
The forecast said there'd be some rainy days, but in fact that didn't happen. It was cloudy rather than sunny, which suited me fine.
Did you go to the coast for your holiday?
Yes, same place every year. I love it. And you can go sailing and windsurfing now.
Right. So is that what you did?
I had hoped to, but as you know, I hurt my foot shortly before leaving, so those sports were out of the question for this year. So I went riding. I managed okay and it was fun.
And did you have good weather?
The forecast said there'd be some rainy days, but in fact that didn't happen. It was cloudy rather than sunny, which suited me fine.
That is the end of the 4 short recordings. In a moment, you will hear question 5. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Question 5. You will hear a young man called Tim Carlton talking to students at his old school about his career as a swimmer. Listen to the talk and complete the details below. Write 1 or 2 words or a number in each gap. You will hear the talk twice.
Good morning, everyone. My name's Tim Carlton and I'm a champion swimmer. I'd like to talk to you today about how my career has developed, which will hopefully inspire any of you who really enjoy swimming to take it up seriously. So, how did it all start? Well, I was very lucky. Where I lived as a child, there were lots of opportunities to go swimming, because we were right near the sea. There were also a couple of great pools to swim in too, although it was in the river close to where we lived that I first began swimming, and I loved it. So even as a 3-year-old, I was a confident swimmer, and I just kept improving. And once I got to 10, I was ready to enter my first race in a school competition. It was something I'd been hoping to do since I was 8, when I discovered I could swim faster than my dad. And how did my career develop? Well, initially I wasn't that keen on competing seriously. It's extremely hard work. But then I joined a club where a coach told me I could win prizes in competitions, and I realised that if I trained harder and became successful, I'd get the opportunity to travel, which was something I'd always wanted to do. So that was it. After that, I began to make a lot of progress. Everyone thought it was because I was getting lots of certificates for my swimming. That was great, of course, but what really made the difference was when I got my driving license, believe it or not. That meant I could get myself to training instead of having to rely on my parents. Once I started training seriously, I swam a lot, of course, but I also went running and did some workouts in the gym too, because all that helped to develop my speed. And in the process, I noticed that my strength was gradually improving too. I've had a few injuries, of course. I broke my arm last year, although I did that playing tennis. But then, when I hurt my shoulder a while ago, it really affected the way I swam. While I was recovering, I had to rely just on my legs, which made them work harder and really developed my muscles. But that also meant my technique got better. So, what advice can I give about becoming a successful swimmer? Well, preparing for races is always important. Obviously, I do lots of exercise. But everything depends on me sleeping enough, otherwise I feel too weak to swim every morning and evening. And I also try to include time for relaxation in my busy routine. And I find a good thing about swimming competitively is that I get to eat a lot of food. So things like pasta and bread are important to boost my energy levels. And of course, sugary foods are important too. Personally, I couldn't manage without bananas, although some swimmers eat a lot of chocolate, which I really can't stand. So if any of you are interested in finding out more about a swimming career, now's your chance to ask questions.
Now you will hear the talk again.
Good morning, everyone. My name's Tim Carlton, and I'm a champion swimmer. I'd like to talk to you today about how my career has developed, which will hopefully inspire any of you who really enjoy swimming to take it up seriously. So, how did it all start? Well, I was very lucky. Where I lived as a child, there were lots of opportunities to go swimming, because we were right near the sea. There were also a couple of great pools to swim in too, although it was in the river close to where we lived that I first began swimming, and I loved it. So even as a three-year-old, I was a confident swimmer, and I just kept improving. And once I got to 10, I was ready to enter my first race in a school competition. It was something I'd been hoping to do since I was 8, when I discovered I could swim faster than my dad. And how did my career develop? Well, initially I wasn't that keen on competing seriously. It's extremely hard work. But then I joined a club where a coach told me I could win prizes in competitions, and I realised that if I trained harder and became successful, I'd get the opportunity to travel, which was something I'd always wanted to do. So that was it. After that, I began to make a lot of progress. Everyone thought it was because I was getting lots of certificates for my swimming. That was great, of course, but what really made the difference was when I got my driving license, believe it or not. That meant I could get myself to training instead of having to rely on my parents. Once I started training seriously, I swam a lot, of course, but I also went running and did some workouts in the gym too, because all that helped to develop my speed. And in the process, I noticed that my strength was gradually improving too. I've had a few injuries, of course. I broke my arm last year, although I did that playing tennis. But then, when I hurt my shoulder a while ago, it really affected the way I swam. While I was recovering, I had to rely just on my legs, which made them work harder and really developed my muscles. But that also meant my technique got better. So, what advice can I give about becoming a successful swimmer? Well, preparing for races is always important. Obviously, I do lots of exercise. But everything depends on me sleeping enough. Otherwise, I feel too weak to swim every morning and evening. And I also try to include time for relaxation in my busy routine. And I find a good thing about swimming competitively is that I get to eat a lot of food. So things like pasta and bread are important to boost my energy levels. And of course, sugary foods are important too. Personally, I couldn't manage without bananas, although some swimmers eat a lot of chocolate, which I really can't stand. So if any of you are interested in finding out more about a swimming career, now's your chance to ask questions.
That is the end of the talk. In a moment, you will hear question 6. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Question 6. You will hear 6 people talking about drawing. For each of speakers 1 to 6, choose from the list A to G which opinion each speaker expresses. Write the letter in the appropriate box. Use each letter only once. There is one extra letter which you do not need to use. You will hear the recordings twice. Speaker 1.
I've just taken up drawing and I love it, but when people ask me why, I never know what to say. I know for some people drawing's a way of expressing themselves, but for me it's been all about developing my imagination. I have loads of ideas in my head for pictures now, although getting them down on paper can be hard, and sometimes I get things wrong and they don't turn out how I planned. But whatever the result, there's something I did, and that makes them special.
Speaker 2.
I guess for some people, drawing's a good way of showing how they feel about anything. But I like looking back at my early drawings and seeing the development of my skills. From initial attempts where I did everything wrong, through to more confident sketches. Although I wasn't bad at drawing even when I first started, I'm definitely seeing more detail now. Angles, shadows, things like that. And that's improved the accuracy of my drawings. I just need to think a bit more carefully before I start.
Speaker 3. I've been drawing for years, and I draw for a while every day, so that I don't forget what I've learnt. And when someone admires what I've produced, like the way I've noticed the detail in something, that does make me feel a whole lot better about myself, and more sure of what I'm doing. Mind you, I still can't sit and focus on drawing for ages at a time. I always find it's better to work with lots of breaks. Otherwise, I run out of ideas. Speaker 4.
Somebody once told me I was very creative, and that sparked a serious interest in drawing. I practice every day now, but it's hard to tell how much I've improved. I used to get upset if I did something wrong and throw a drawing away and start again. Now, though, I'm confident I can get a better result if I just keep working away at a drawing until I'm happy with it. I'm planning to do a drawing course soon, so I'll be able to apply the same technique there.
Speaker 5.
I draw whatever I find growing in the garden to create pictures, but I find I still don't observe the plants carefully enough to see what they really look like, rather than what I imagine they're like. When I first began drawing, I found it hard to sit and draw for hours. I'd just start feeling bored. Nowadays, I get really absorbed in what I'm doing, and I forget about other things completely, which is great. And that's helped me with other areas of life too, like my academic studies.
Speaker 6.
My friend and I sit and draw together. She has lots of imaginative ideas for pictures, and I encourage her to draw them, as she's not very confident about her skills. I've realised, though, that to produce good pictures, I have to think before I start, instead of jumping straight in, only to find I haven't got the right materials, and then getting really annoyed with myself. At least I've always been able to draw what I see in front of me, rather than what I think is there. But there's always room for improvement.
Now you will hear the six speakers again. Speaker 1.
I've just taken up drawing and I love it, but when people ask me why, I never know what to say. I know for some people drawing's a way of expressing themselves, but for me it's been all about developing my imagination. I have loads of ideas in my head for pictures now, although getting them down on paper can be hard. And sometimes I get things wrong and they don't turn out how I planned. But whatever the result, there's something I did, and that makes them special.
Speaker 2.
I guess for some people, drawing's a good way of showing how they feel about anything. But I like looking back at my early drawings and seeing the development of my skills, from initial attempts where I did everything wrong, through to more confident sketches. Although I wasn't bad at drawing even when I first started, I'm definitely seeing more detail now. Angles, shadows, things like that. And that's improved the accuracy of my drawings. I just need to think a bit more carefully before I start.
Speaker 3. I've been drawing for years, and I draw for a while every day, so that I don't forget what I've learnt. And when someone admires what I've produced, like the way I've noticed the detail in something, that does make me feel a whole lot better about myself, and more sure of what I'm doing. Mind you, I still can't sit and focus on drawing for ages at a time. I always find it's better to work with lots of breaks. Otherwise, I run out of ideas. Speaker 4.
Somebody once told me I was very creative, and that sparked a serious interest in drawing. I practice every day now, but it's hard to tell how much I've improved. I used to get upset if I did something wrong and throw a drawing away and start again. Now, though, I'm confident I can get a better result if I just keep working away at a drawing until I'm happy with it. I'm planning to do a drawing course soon, so I'll be able to apply the same technique there.
Speaker 5.
I draw whatever I find growing in the garden to create pictures, but I find I still don't observe the plants carefully enough to see what they really look like, rather than what I imagine they're like. When I first began drawing, I found it hard to sit and draw for hours. I'd just start feeling bored. Nowadays, I get really absorbed in what I'm doing and I forget about other things completely, which is great. And that's helped me with other areas of life too, like my academic studies.
Speaker 6.
My friend and I sit and draw together. She has lots of imaginative ideas for pictures, and I encourage her to draw them, as she's not very confident about her skills. I've realised, though, that to produce good pictures, I have to think before I start, instead of jumping straight in, only to find I haven't got the right materials, and then getting really annoyed with myself. At least I've always been able to draw what I see in front of me, rather than what I think is there. But there's always room for improvement.
That is the end of question 6. In a moment, you will hear question 7. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Question 7. You will hear an interview with an archaeologist called Kate Lee, who works on ancient sites to discover their history. Listen to the interview and look at the questions. For each question, choose the correct answer, A, B, or C, and put a tick in the appropriate box. You will hear the interview twice.
Today I'm with Kate Lee, an archaeologist, someone who finds out about human history by excavating different sites. Kate, it sounds an exciting job. How did you start?
Oh, I began by volunteering with other students, exploring an ancient site in Spain, a 5th century town. Archaeologists were digging there, uncovering different ancient buildings hidden for centuries under the ground, like a typical house and a traditional farm where they grew food. And also a big castle, which was what I worked on. We found lots of items there, like ancient coins and pots. It was fascinating.
So how did it feel to be on a historical site for the first time?
Well, most people say they feel a sense of anxiety that they might do something wrong, although there are plenty of professionals around to give advice. But I couldn't wait to get started. Then, while I was digging in the ground, looking for historical objects, I was in such a hurry to see what was there that I ended up breaking something important. I was really frustrated with myself about that. It didn't stop me studying archaeology, though.
And now you're leading a team working on another site?
Yes, a company wants to buy the land from the owner, although he's not keen. Anyway, they're hoping to construct a big cinema and sports complex on the site. But before they can go any further, we have to check there's nothing interesting or valuable underneath the soil, and that takes time. In the meantime, though, our activities have brought tourists to the area, which is good for local businesses.
But the site originally looked like an ordinary field. What made you think there might be something important there?
Well, we noticed there was a strange hill in the middle of the field, and the soil was a different colour in some places. That suggested there might have once been a building on the hill, and possibly even a village under the soil. We didn't have any old records to help us, though, like we sometimes do. One or two people had discovered strange objects there, but they turned out to be quite recent stuff, not ancient at all.
So, have you found anything exciting?
Oh, yes. Well, it won't seem exciting, but we've uncovered an ancient wooden path, a walkway that people actually used 4,000 years ago to cross what was once a very wet area. Of course, it's damaged and too fragile to walk across anymore, but you can clearly see how they'd constructed it and repaired it over the centuries. And that was important for us. Amazing.
So what happens to the things you find?
Well, we don't know exactly what they are until they've been washed carefully. So we do that on the spot and then sort them, pieces of pottery or tools, say. Then often a local specialist will come and have a look. Usually they're from the nearest museum and are very knowledgeable.
And I know you enjoy finding pieces of pottery. Why is that?
Well, it's one of the indicators we use to decide the age of the site. And it's interesting to see whether we're looking at basic kitchen pots or more decorated pots for the table to impress guests. But if we find pots made from non-local materials, that can suggest that other people came to the area to sell their goods. And to me, that's amazing.
So you're obviously still enjoying the job. What keeps you interested?
Well, we're discovering the unknown, you know, evidence of how people have lived in the past. You see what things they used in their homes, how they organised their towns. But when you realise they experienced the same basic problems we still have today, how to provide food, water and shelter for our families, that convinces me that I couldn't be in a better job.
Kate, thank you very much for your time.
Now you will hear the interview again.
Today I'm with Kate Lee, an archaeologist, someone who finds out about human history by excavating different sites. Kate, it sounds an exciting job. How did you start?
Oh, I began by volunteering with other students, exploring an ancient site in Spain, a 5th century town. Archaeologists were digging there, uncovering different ancient buildings hidden for centuries under the ground, like a typical house and a traditional farm where they grew food, and also a big castle, which was what I worked on. We found lots of items there, like ancient coins and pots. It was fascinating.
So how did it feel to be on a historical site for the first time?
Well, most people say they feel a sense of anxiety that they might do something wrong, although there are plenty of professionals around to give advice. But I couldn't wait to get started. Then, while I was digging in the ground looking for historical objects, I was in such a hurry to see what was there that I ended up breaking something important. I was really frustrated with myself about that. It didn't stop me studying archaeology, though.
And now you're leading a team working on another site.
Yes, a company wants to buy the land from the owner, although he's not keen. Anyway, they're hoping to construct a big cinema and sports complex on the site. But before they can go any further, we have to check there's nothing interesting or valuable underneath the soil, and that takes time. In the meantime, though, our activities have brought tourists to the area, which is good for local businesses.
But the site originally looked like an ordinary field. What made you think there might be something important there?
Well, we noticed there was a strange hill in the middle of the field, and the soil was a different colour in some places. That suggested there might have once been a building on the hill, and possibly even a village under the soil. We didn't have any old records to help us, though, like we sometimes do. One or two people had discovered strange objects there, but they turned out to be quite recent stuff, not ancient at all.
So, have you found anything exciting?
Oh, yes. Well, it won't seem exciting, but we've uncovered an ancient wooden path, a walkway that people actually used 4,000 years ago to cross what was once a very wet area. Of course, it's damaged and too fragile to walk across anymore, but you can clearly see how they'd constructed it and repaired it over the centuries, and that was important for us. Amazing.
So what happens to the things you find?
Well, we don't know exactly what they are until they've been washed carefully, so we do that on the spot and then sort them, pieces of pottery or tools, say. Then often a local specialist will come and have a look. Usually they're from the nearest museum and are very knowledgeable.
And I know you enjoy finding pieces of pottery. Why is that?
Well, it's one of the indicators we use to decide the age of the site. And it's interesting to see whether we're looking at basic kitchen pots or more decorated pots for the table to impress guests. But if we find pots made from non-local materials, that can suggest that other people came to the area to sell their goods. And to me, that's amazing.
So you're obviously still enjoying the job. What keeps you interested?
Well, we're discovering the unknown, you know, evidence of how people have lived in the past. You see what things they used in their homes, how they organised their towns. But when you realise they experienced the same basic problems we still have today, how to provide food, water and shelter for our families, that convinces me that I couldn't be in a better job.
Kate, thank you very much for your time.
That is the end of the interview. In a moment, you will hear question 8. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Question 8. Part A. You will hear a man called James Morton giving a talk about his conservation work involving sea creatures called Hawaiian monk seals. Listen to the talk and complete the sentences in Part A. Write one or two words or a number in each gap. You will hear the talk twice.
Hello everyone. My name is James Morton, and I'm a researcher in conservation. I've been involved in monitoring creatures called Hawaiian monk seals, and I'd like to tell you about my work with them. Now, you may not have heard of these animals, but we think they've been around for thousands of years. In the last 25 years, though, their numbers have decreased rapidly in the wild, and at the time we started our research project, we believed they were down to about 1,100. However, there was still hope. For example, a small group of 15 later established itself around the main Hawaiian islands and grew to a colony of around 200 in a relatively short time. Now, you might think it was possible that this colony of seals would be disturbed by tourists and other visitors to the area, such as developers along the coast. However, the fact that they were located in heavily populated areas was not the main issue. The worry was that the creatures could easily find themselves in conflict with fishermen, as they were competing in the same ocean areas for the same food sources. The seals spend most of their time at sea, but come ashore to rest on beaches and shelter when necessary. Mother seals remain with their young constantly for the first 6 weeks of their lives. What has impressed me since studying them is not so much their hunting skills as their devotion to ensuring the survival of their offspring. They feed them constantly during this time, often losing weight themselves in the process. A central part of our research was attaching a video camera called a Criticam to the seals to study how they lived. As the project began, our team went out to beaches where we hoped to find seals. Walking to look for them in high temperatures while carrying bulky equipment was hot and heavy work. Though occasional storms tended to improve things for us as the seals were easier to reach. Our team then selected various seals to attach cameras to. We needed to do preliminary checks on water temperature and location, and also on the creature's fur, to make sure we could fit the camera to it. And sedating the seals also allowed us to take blood samples and check the amount of fat they were carrying. Once the seals were released, they'd head quickly towards the ocean and disappear, with our cameras attached.
Now you will hear the talk again.
Hello everyone, my name is James Morton and I'm a researcher in conservation. I've been involved in monitoring creatures called Hawaiian monk seals and I'd like to tell you about my work with them. Now you may not have heard of these animals, but we think they've been around for thousands of years. In the last 25 years though, their numbers have decreased rapidly in the wild. And at the time we started our research project, we believed they were down to about 1,100. However, there was still hope. For example, a small group of 15 later established itself around the main Hawaiian islands and grew to a colony of around 200 in a relatively short time. Now, you might think it was possible that this colony of seals would be disturbed by tourists and other visitors to the area, such as developers along the coast. However, the fact that they were located in heavily populated areas was not the main issue. The worry was that the creatures could easily find themselves in conflict with fishermen, as they were competing in the same ocean areas for the same food sources. The seals spend most of their time at sea, but come ashore to rest on beaches and shelter when necessary. Mother seals remain with their young constantly for the first 6 weeks of their lives. What has impressed me since studying them is not so much their hunting skills as their devotion to ensuring the survival of their offspring. They feed them constantly during this time, often losing weight themselves in the process. A central part of our research was attaching a video camera called a Criticam to the seals to study how they lived. As the project began, our team went out to beaches where we hoped to find seals. Walking to look for them in high temperatures while carrying bulky equipment was hot and heavy work. Though occasional storms tended to improve things for us as the seals were easier to reach. Our team then selected various seals to attach cameras to. We needed to do preliminary checks on water temperature and location, and also on the creature's fur, to make sure we could fit the camera to it. And sedating the seals also allowed us to take blood samples and check the amount of fat they were carrying. Once the seals were released, they'd head quickly towards the ocean and disappear, with our cameras attached.
Question 8, Part B. Now listen to a conversation between two researchers about the Criticam video camera for monitoring wildlife and complete the details in Part B. Write one or two words only in each gap. You will hear the conversation twice.
That was a really interesting talk about the Hawaiian monk seals and how researchers observed them using a video camera. The Criticam, wasn't it?
Yes, and the stuff about the Criticam was incredible. Attaching a video camera to the animals to watch them 24/7, it's a brilliant idea.
And did you know the device can not only make video and audio recordings, it can also collect information on what they eat and where they live, right down to data on their depth under the water at any given time. It reveals so much about their lives and will hopefully help in conserving them.
Absolutely. And I've read that researchers haven't been confined to using the Criticam on Hawaiian monk seals. Apparently it's been used on other sea creatures, like whales and penguins, and animals from forest and mountain areas, like black bears as well. At some stage they're hoping to research grey wolves too.
Yes, that's right. Anyway, do you know about the origin of the Criticam?
I read that it was someone called Greg Marshall who had the idea, but I don't know much more than that. Was he a filmmaker? I'm sure I've seen some things he's done.
Oh, I don't know about that.
He must have been quite a technician to have come up with the idea.
Well, I know he was a marine biologist when he first started thinking about the Criticam.
Right.
And I believe the idea came to him when he was under the water during a diving trip to Belize to observe giant jellyfish, I think. Anyway, he hadn't expected to be approached by a large shark, which then quickly disappeared again with a tiny suckerfish clinging to it. He then realised that if something so small could attach itself and not be noticed, then a camera could be used in the same way.
Wow. And of course the technology used in the Criticam has advanced since it was first thought of, so I guess it was a sophisticated piece of equipment at the time.
And it certainly allowed researchers to see film footage that they wouldn't have been able to get in any other way. I've no doubt it was a significant innovation for the protection of wildlife.
Now you will hear the conversation again.
That was a really interesting talk about the Hawaiian monk seals and how researchers observed them using a video camera. The Criticam, wasn't it?
Yes, and the stuff about the Criticam was incredible. Attaching a video camera to the animals to watch them 24/7, it's a brilliant idea.
And did you know the device can not only make video and audio recordings, it can also collect information on what they eat and where they live, right down to data on their depth under the water at any given time. It reveals so much about their lives and will hopefully help in conserving them.
Absolutely. And I've read that researchers haven't been confined to using the Criticam on Hawaiian monk seals. Apparently it's been used on other sea creatures, like whales and penguins, and animals from forest and mountain areas, like black bears as well. At some stage, they're hoping to research grey wolves too.
Yes, that's right. Anyway, do you know about the origin of the Criticam?
I read that it was someone called Greg Marshall who had the idea, but I don't know much more than that. Was he a filmmaker? I'm sure I've seen some things he's done.
Oh, I don't know about that.
He must have been quite a technician to have come up with the idea.
Well, I know he was a marine biologist when he first started thinking about the Criticam.
Right.
And I believe the idea came to him when he was under the water during a diving trip to Belize to observe giant jellyfish, I think. Anyway, he hadn't expected to be approached by a large shark, which then quickly disappeared again with a tiny suckerfish clinging to it. He then realised that if something so small could attach itself and not be noticed, then a camera could be used in the same way.
Wow. And of course the technology used in the Criticam has advanced since it was first thought of, so I guess it was a sophisticated piece of equipment at the time.
And it certainly allowed researchers to see film footage that they wouldn't have been able to get in any other way. I've no doubt it was a significant innovation for the protection of wildlife.
That is the end of question 8 and of the exam. In a moment, your teacher will collect your papers. Please check that you have written your name, centre number and candidate number on the front of your question paper. Remember, you must not talk until all the papers have been collected. Teacher, please collect all the papers.